This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Welcome to our second year of podcast with educational researchers who are investigating some of the most critical issues currently affecting U.S. schools. Today, I will be speaking with Patricia Gandara, the co-director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. She and her colleagues recently completed a study of the impact of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement policies on schools, looking in particular at their effects on children from immigrant families, but also on their teachers, school principals, and counselors, as well as their classmates, regardless of background. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you, Greg.
To begin with, can you describe the work of the UCLA Civil Rights Project in general? What kinds of issues do you investigate?
Oh, my goodness. We investigate a broad swath of issues that affect young people, affect their schools, their schooling, their education, including things like housing policy, which affects what schools they go to, including segregation issues, language issues, access to higher education, and in this case, immigration. But we've been around for more than 20 years, and we've published something like 500 studies on a lot of different things affecting kids and their education.
Why did you decide at this point in time to focus on immigration questions as part of the Civil Rights Project's work?
Well, I think, you know, being a civil rights organization, it would have been almost impossible for us not to, since this is having such an enormous effect on children of color, on immigrant students, on children in who were in low-performing schools and living in poor neighborhoods. It's really quite pervasive. And I in particular have been reading numerous accounts of the effects of the current immigration policy on families and on their children, and just horrifying stories about the children. But I was noticing that nobody seemed to be talking about what was going on with the schools that these children attended. And that seemed to be a really important thing for us to take a look at.
How is this enforcement regime different from what existed in the past?
Well, it's quite different. So under the Obama administration, particularly in the early years of the Obama administration, as we can all reflect back on, President Obama was convinced, I don't know by whom, but was convinced that if he was really, really strong on enforcement, that the Republican Congress would come around and support some kind of immigration reform. And so it is quite true that during several years of the Obama administration, there was very harsh enforcement, and it was having a very bad impact. But in the latter years, I think once he realized that immigration reform was not going to happen, the administration really changed its focus. And rather than just sporadic and kind of ad hoc enforcement across the country, they were really focusing on the border, stopping illegal immigration at the border, and criminals. So families came to feel pretty confident that if they'd been here for a long time, they had children in the schools, they were keeping their nose clean, doing everything they're supposed to do, that they really weren't at risk. And for the most part, that was in fact the case.
So the recent changes altered the sense of security and stability undocumented immigrants had become used to.
Well, even before the Trump administration began, of course, since this campaign of his was so virulently anti-immigrant, people began getting very nervous. But then certainly on day one of the Trump administration, we had massive raids that are totally unanticipated in areas where nobody felt like this was going to happen, and targeting people who've been here for decades and raised families in this country.
So approximately how many students in U.S. schools are being directly impacted by current immigration enforcement policies?
You know, it's really, nobody's collecting data on this, and I'm not even quite sure how we would collect those data. But what we can say is that we have millions of families in the U.S. who have, more than 5 million kids have at least one parent who is undocumented. So start with that and add to that the DACA kids, and you've got up around 6 million young people. And one of the things that we found, which I'd like to talk a little bit more about at some point in our conversation, is the degree to which this is affecting kids who have nothing to do with immigration. This is affecting the other kids in the schools where these young people who are living in families that are being targeted are going to school. So their classmates are also affected, even if they're not targets. So there are many, many millions of children and families that are being affected by this.
How did you go about studying the impact of these immigration enforcement policies on schools?
Well, as anyone who's ever done research in schools knows, the first stage of this has to be beyond, determining what kinds of questions we want to ask and reviewing the literature, is developing relationships with school districts that will allow you to come in and do this. And that's a big challenge for a number of reasons. School districts don't necessarily like to have researchers coming in from the outside, and particularly around something that is presently a very hot topic. In going about doing this, the first things we had to do was establish relationships with school districts around the country, because we knew we also wanted to get a representative look. So we went to the four different regions, census regions in the country, the Northeast, the South, the West, and the Midwest, and began to use the contacts that we had over many, many years of doing research out in the field to invite districts to participate with us. We initially invited 47 districts across the country, and of those, 24 districts agreed to participate.
And what sorts of questions did you ask, and who did you ask the questions of?
Those are good questions. And it really does matter. So, this was a very short survey, because, again, we wanted to assure people that we were not going to use up a lot of their time. This was not going to be a huge burden on the schools, and that people really could answer this survey in about 5 minutes, maybe seven if they decide to write more in there, but in about 5 minutes. So we kept it to 10 basic questions about the impact on kids, on the impact on parents, on absenteeism and such questions, which I'll talk more in depth about. And let me see, the second part of your question was?
Which people did you ask the questions of?
So I'm really glad we decided to do this. We were interested in hearing from a number of people in the school. So we surveyed principals and administrators. We surveyed teachers. We surveyed counselors and other certificated personnel. And in some districts, people really asked us to please include other individuals, like their janitors or whatever. So we have a broad representation of people. Overwhelmingly, it's teachers. But about 8% of the sample is administrators, and that became very important because they have a broader view of what's happening in the schools. And then about 8% also were counselors or people working in those kinds of jobs.
And how many surveys did you get back from the districts you'd sent them to?
So we did an initial question to find out just, is this a problem? So we didn't want to assume that it was a problem. So we did this initial question, have you noticed anything, any impact on the children in your school and the students of immigration enforcement? About 5,000 people responded to that question, and about 1,500 said, no, they hadn't noticed any such thing. So at that point, we didn't continue to pursue the survey with them. but about 3,500 people said, yes, they had. And those individuals, well, actually more than 3,500, but 3,500 said, yes, they had, and that, and they completed the full survey.
What impacts did you discover this enforcement regime is having on students and families where someone may be undocumented?
You know, this is really kind of heart-rending stuff, actually, Greg, because I guess in a, as a general statement, I would say that there's millions of young people, millions of students out there who are really suffering. I occasionally had to put down the surveys and go take a walk or do something else because it's painful. It's painful to hear what some of the children are going through. A fourth grade child who tells her teacher that her mother is teaching her how to make food for her baby sister in case the ice comes for the mom and she has to take care of her baby sister. A young lady who went to the prom, came home, her mother had been deported, and she tried to slit her wrists. There's just story after story, but let me tell you what the sort of overview of this. About 80% of the people who responded to this survey from, you know, all corners of the country said that they had observed behavioral changes, differences in the behavior of and problematic behaviors on the part of students who were at risk, who had some family member. You know, and it isn't always a parent. Sometimes it's an older sibling. Sometimes it's an aunt or an uncle. Somewhat surprising to me is how many people mentioned their grandparents, that their grandparents were living with them, and it was the grandparent who was undocumented, and just the whole family was in uproar and concern about this. But in any case, about a quarter of those 80% who said that they had observed these kinds of behavioral issues in students said it was really extensive. It was really very problematic. 84% of our respondents said that their kids had expressed concerns. They were talking about it. This was a topic, an issue for the kids, that they were talking to somebody in the school about their worries. And more than a third said that this was, again, really extensive. This was really preoccupying the kids excessively about what could happen to them. In more than half of the schools, more than half of the respondents in these schools said that absenteeism had become a problem. And now this is a problem on multiple levels, right? Because absenteeism obviously hurts the student. If you're not there, you can't learn and you get seriously behind and then you fall behind in school and your chances of completing school become less and less. But it's also a big problem for the schools because schools don't get their funds if students don't attend. So in addition to having to cope with all of the attendant problems of this in the school, their funds are reduced when the students don't come to school. 70% of the administrators and the counselors said that they had observed academic decline, that they had observed that the kids, grades were going down, that their commitment to schooling was less. And I think what surprised me was how many high school teachers talked about their best students giving up. Kids who were set and ready to go on to college, who had been very high performers, saying to their teacher, there's no point. And many of them deciding that they were just going to leave school and get a job because it was now more important for them to help support their family than to think about a future education, which had now been put at such risk. They didn't know if there was any future for them. And two-thirds of the respondents then talked about how what was going on with these kids and in the school had a major indirect effect on the other students. So one of the images that I have from all of these surveys that I've read through and the comments that people have made is the one of the empty desk You know, when the students come in the morning and all of a sudden there's an empty desk. And that empty desk was their friend. That was sometimes their best friend. That was their classmate. They'd gone to school together. They cared about each other. And this young person is now gone, and nobody knows where to or what happened. And that, teachers talk about how that just sets a pall over the classroom. And the other students become agitated and concerned because of what's happening around them.
And what's particularly disturbing is the fact that much as this is happening in schools where teachers are attempting to close the achievement gap.
Yeah, that's a point, Greg, that we've wanted to make too. 83% of our respondents were in Title I schools. And so those are the very schools that are already struggling with massive problems. These are the schools in the lowest income areas serving the most at-risk kids. And, you know, oftentimes just feeling like they're barely treading water. And then to have this laid on top of them, I fear is just pushing people to the breaking point.
Could you say more about how these policies have played out with regard to the working lives of teachers and principals and school counselors?
You know, that's something else that hasn't been talked much about, and I'm so happy that you asked that question, because this really jumped out at us as well. One of the things we know from the research is that if you have a struggling school, if you have, say, a Title I school, one of the things that you can count on to improve the situation is a shared mission, right? I mean, good schools have a shared mission. Everybody's on the same page. Everybody knows where they're headed and what their goals are and what they need to do to achieve those goals. Well, that we saw really breaking down in these schools because a sense of trust was breaking down among the teachers and the administrators and other personnel in the schools. Teachers talked to us about, or wrote to us, about how they no longer knew who to trust. Because if they had a student in their classroom who had mentioned to them that something was going on in their home and they were very concerned or were afraid to come to school because when they got home, their parents might be there, teachers didn't know who they could share this information with. If the teacher next door or down the hall was actually someone who would report this family. And so the sense of trust that is so necessary was really breaking down. Others talked to us about how they really wanted to address these issues in the classroom. They felt it was a topic that really needed to be dealt with. And yet, when they did, as one teacher said, whenever I mention anything, I can count on getting a phone call from some parent who's outraged that I raised the topic. And so they didn't even know if they could safely discuss things with their students. So it's creating this sense that the teachers are often affected deeply also by the students disappearing from their classrooms, students breaking down and crying, students coming to them with all kinds of concerns that the teacher doesn't know what to do with. One teacher talked about how a parent had come and asked her if the teacher would take her children because she was being deported. So there's this enormous personal stress on these teachers, a breaking down of a sense of trust amongst faculty and even with the parents, not knowing what they can or can't say.
Are there any things teachers and school administrators are doing to attempt to mitigate the impact of these immigration enforcement policies and practices?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that more than 80%, and I think it was more like 88% actually, of the respondents said they thought it was critical that the schools reach out to the families and provide some kinds of information forums for parents and other community members with just information about what's true, what's not true. One of the things that happens in these situations is there's a lot of rumor, and somebody hears something or thinks something and they mention it to somebody else, and all of a sudden there's a rumor running through the community that ICE is going to show up this afternoon and then everybody keeps their kids at home. And of course, that doesn't help anybody. So people need realistic information, what they can do, what, you know, what has happened or could happen and what has not. But almost three quarters of the respondents said that they hadn't done so. They felt this was really critical, really important, but it hadn't happened in their school. And I believe that from conversations we've had actually with a number of people since releasing this study, I believe this is because people don't know what to do. And people in the schools need information about what's legal, what's not legal. Can we have a forum for parents in which we invite an immigration lawyer? Is that legal or is that not legal? What kinds of things do parents and families need to do to prepare? So there's a lot of information that we need to get out to families, but schools don't know really how to do it.
This is a good segue to my next question. What policy recommendations do you have for local school districts in addition to providing information? Are there other things that districts could be investing in?
Yeah, you know, I just recently was talking with somebody who was working with school boards who was asking me what should school boards be doing. And I have to say that I think the school boards around the country need to take this on. They need to, you know, there are differences community by community and state by state. So there's no simple, straightforward answer to what's legal and what's not legal, or, you know, what are you going to get in trouble for doing with families. But school boards need to take this on and figure out what practices are in their communities, what kinds of things their ed code allows them to do or doesn't allow them to do. But they need to help schools know how to handle these problems, and administrators then need to know how to help their teachers and their other school personnel to know how to handle these issues. So there needs to be a lot of professional development all along the way. But with respect to the communities, there in every community, pretty much, there are nonprofits, there are community organizations that are working on these issues and that can be supportive. Schools need to know who those people are, where they are, and make connections with them so that they can, at the very least, refer families to some reliable sources. There's also been a fair amount of work that has been done by people like MALDEF and the ACLU in outlining for immigrant parents what kinds of what their rights are, because they do have rights as individuals in this country. You know, the Constitution refers almost always to persons within the country rather than citizens. And so immigrants, no matter what their status, actually do have certain rights, and they need to know what those are.
What kinds of things can local and state-level policymakers do to attempt to reduce the impact of these federal immigration enforcement activities?
Well, you know, it's in terms of reducing the federal activities, there's not a whole lot that we can do. But and we've seen how in Oakland, the superintendent there got into a lot of hot water for alerting families when she found that there was going to be an ICE raid. I won't get into that. I'm not going to say this is what people should be doing, although I admire her for having done that. But at the state level, I think that there's a couple things that I've talked with legislators here in California about this. We need a little bit of funding for the schools to be able to do these kinds of forums. We could use some policy that says that school districts need to inform their communities about immigration enforcement and about what their rights are, and help them then with some targeted funding to do these kinds of outreach efforts to the community. Because, as I say, you know, there are few places anymore in this country that are not being affected by this. Because if you have just one immigrant family that's at risk, we know that the child that comes from that family goes into a school where this is affecting everyone else around them.
Moving further up the ladder, what do you think Congress and the court should be doing to support the more than 5 million students currently being threatened by immigration and customs enforcement agents and other federal officials?
You know, Greg, at the end of the Obama administration in 2014, towards the end, President Obama introduced what was called DAPA. Let me see if I can remember what DAPA stands for. Deferred Action for Parents of American Citizens. And that, I don't know how much publicity this actually got, but it was shot down right away by the Fifth Circuit. It went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was deadlocked. And so the Fifth Circuit's opinion held, which was that he had overstepped his bounds in doing this. But this, something like DAPA would solve this problem. DAPA was intended for exactly the issue that we're talking about, that these children who are 90%, at least 90% of these kids are U.S. citizens. This is an important point. I'm sorry, I should have gotten to much earlier. But overwhelmingly, these children who are in our Title I schools, who are suffering through these horrendous situations, they're U.S. citizen kids. They have every right to be here. They have every right to services here in this country. But it's because somebody in their family, you know, and in the case of DAPA, a parent doesn't have proper documentation, that the kids are being made to suffer. I would hope that we could take a look at the impact this is having on millions and millions of kids in our most struggling schools in the country and revisit the notion of something like DAPA, which would take the pressure off these kids. You know, I think that those people who opposed this saw this as somehow an amnesty that was giving a free ride to parents who many times been here for decades. But in fact, what it does is it takes the onus off of the children who are U.S. citizen kids.
And they are our future in many respects as well.
Here in California, Greg, half of our kids come from immigrant homes. So this state, which is the fifth largest economy in the world and a huge driver of the U.S. economy, is really suffering from these kinds of policies because, in fact, this is our future.
Exactly. Many thanks, Patricia, for helping us to better understand the consequences of current immigration enforcement practices on U.S. schools and their students as well as teachers. What is clear from your research is that this enforcement regime is affecting a much broader proportion of our fellow citizens than is generally conveyed by the media or public officials. This is Greg Smith for the National Education Policy Center. October's Education Interview of the Month will be with Dr. Gordon Lafer, a political economist at the University of Oregon, who published a research report last spring about the sizable financial impacts of charter schools on district budgets in Oakland, San Diego, and Santa Clara County in California. Impacts that are seriously constraining their capacity to educate students in the classrooms of their district-operated schools. We invite you to join us again for another podcast.